Welcome to the Queer Movie Podcast, celebrating the best and worst in LGBTQ plus cinema one glorious genre at a time. I'm Rowan Ellis, and welcome to one of our special guest episodes. Today we are joined by a special guest who will be answering the question, what movies made you queer? I am very excited to welcome Trevor Anderson, director of new queer coming-of-age movie, Before I Change My Mind. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, Rowan.
Very excited to have a little chat with you. We're going to be talking about, we say movies that made you queer. It's this conversation on these guest episodes often runs the full length of this was a character who I found hot and that confused me as a teenager, all the way to like this was something I watched the other day and it was like watching my own life on screen and it was very emotionally poignant. So kind of we're digging into all elements of what queerness is, whether it's to do with sexuality, identity, community, internal, external, all of that. But with that in mind, we use the word queer as a bit of an umbrella term in this kind of format, but do you use any other words to describe your identities, anything like that we might be digging into?
Queer is definitely my favorite. I came of age in the 90s, you know, and so I was at university. I remember a student group at the university spent a year debating whether it should change its name from Gaylock to like something with a B in it, because aren't we erasing bisexuals? And, you know, but what are we going to call it? Gablock? And that conversation went on for a year, to the point that my friends and I got so frustrated that we said, let's start our own group and we'll call it Queer Academy. So I was an early adopter of the, you know, queer politics of the 90s, and they've never really left me. So queer is definitely a word I am very comfortable in.
I feel like these conversations kind of go cyclically, because I was also at uni in like sort of 2010, like that turn of that decade. And it was the exact same conversation, but with whether it was LGBT, LGBTQ plus, were you using a star now? Is that how we're going to do it? So I'm, yeah, intimately familiar with the intricacies of naming a community, which is so like huge and nebulous in a way.
Yeah.
I love that. So I often ask guests when they bring these sort of offerings to me at the altar of queer moviedom to give me them in whatever order they fancy. Some people it's from, you know, their youngest to most recent movie. Sometimes it is the most to the least hinged movie. Do you have a particular order we're going to go in, or are we kind of just going to wind our little queer way through the map of your movie watching history?
Yeah, I don't really have a taxonomy for this. The first movie that sprang into my mind when I was invited to talk to you about this was Stand By Me, the Rob Reiner movie from the 80s starring Will Wheaton and River Phoenix. And I think because it was such a touchstone for my own movie, Before I Change My Mind, in a way, Stand By Me isn't itself an explicitly queer movie. It's about a friendship between these two young teenage boys. I don't know, are they maybe, I think they're supposed to be around 14 is my guess. That's my sense of it anyway. That's my memory of it. Maybe I was 14 when I saw it. The movie came out in 86. But this friendship between Will Wheaton, if we were to write Stand By Me now, it would be a good move to make the Will Wheaton character the little gay boy. Like he's, you know, he's clean. He's got the haircut. Mm-hmm. His shirt is tucked into his trousers. I think it's set in the 50s, even though it's an 80s movie. But like this is the coding that I was like, oh, I can relate to this slightly prissy, you know, good student, good boy kind of character of Will Wheaton. And there's this great friendship with River Phoenix from The Wrong Side of the Tracks. That character is the bad boy, you know. They're in kind of like, not really a gang. The older brothers are definitely in a gang. That's the Kiefer Sutherland as Ace. And then there's like Ace's sidekick is called Eyeball. And that's the River Phoenix's older brother. So like the older brothers are dangerous, bad kids. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you get the sense that you're meeting the River Phoenix character at a crossroads where he doesn't want to become a juvenile delinquent like his older brother. He likes his friendship with the Will Wheaton character. And then there's four of them in total, and they go off looking for, they've heard there's a dead body of a kid out in the woods, and they go off to try to find it. Sort of out of a morbid curiosity, sort of out of a desire to be heroes. Mm-hmm. They think that the town will welcome them back as heroes if they find this kid's body. So they set off to do that. And there's this beautiful friendship between the Will Wheaton and River Phoenix characters that did my queer heart good. Like that, I think, is just add a bit of romance, and that's the movie I wanted. It's a good friendship.
I think it's one of those things with movies, especially ones that we watch as we're coming of age that aren't necessarily explicitly queer themselves, where in part because there weren't any explicitly queer coming of age movies when we were coming of age, that you end up having to find your own narrative in there, your own coding, your own reading of it, your own sort of wish fulfillment, sort of a fan fiction alternate universe of Stand By Me or whatever the movie is that was like, I have a character that either this character feels like me and so I want to see myself in them, or this feels like it's a version of my life that is either really similar to mine or very different but kind of what I wanted or what is a secret desire of my heart. So it makes a lot of sense to me that there is a movie in here which is not explicitly queer itself but that you found that you resonated with. Was that something that you were resonating with at the time and realizing why, or is that something that years down the line you look back on and go, oh, I know what was going on in my teenage brain. I know what was happening there.
I think the latter. I don't think at the time that I was necessarily reading it explicitly as, oh, wouldn't this be great if it was a queer coming of age movie? You know, I was crushed out on River Phoenix. There's this interesting thing that happened to me that I think happens to a lot of queer people where I think one of the reasons maybe sometimes we're good at holding simultaneous contradictory truths in our minds is because until you really, like, accept that you're queer, of course you're straight. Everyone's mm-hmm. straight. You've been raised as straight. Of course you are. But then you know in your heart that you're crushed out on River Phoenix. It's Dead by Me. So there's these two things that are going on. Like, I'm crushed out on him, but of course I'm not queer. So later, I think once that resolved in my brain, I was able to. And once I saw a pattern of liking bad boys, right? Because that's where this goes. And that's why, like in my movie, the hero Robin is crushed out on Carter. And it's very much Will Wheaton could have, you know, it's a Will Wheaton-y kind of character for Robin. And it's a River Phoenix-y kind of character for Carter. But it's not, Robin doesn't get the good relationship of Stand By Me. You know, Robin gets a Carter who has his own problems and is a bit unhinged because of it. That's a pattern in my life. That's a pattern in the movies I like. It's that dangerous bad boy love interest is definitely something I've talked about with my therapist a lot.
So speaking of your movie, do you have the couple of sentence summary of in terms of what people would expect if they saw it? You've mentioned that the Stand By Me was kind of an inspiration of some kind. What are those similarities? Like, how does that match up together? Or is it specifically that relationship dynamic?
Well, yeah, that's the heart of the film. And then it becomes a love triangle once a character named Izzy enters the picture. And she's a beautiful singer in the community theater musical. But the way I describe the movie for people who haven't seen it is 1987. New kid Robin comes to school, and while the other students wonder if Robin is a boy or a girl, Robin falls in with the school bully and starts making increasingly dangerous choices to get popular. So at the beginning of the movie, we raise this question, is that a boy or a girl? And we never go there. You know, I think people expect the movie to go there, to have some kind of gender reveal scene, to have some kind of trope. You know, the trope is a violent gender reveal scene. That's what we're expecting. But we just never even go there at all. My writing partner, Fish Gorkowski, and I set as a challenge for ourselves to write the whole movie without any gendered pronouns for Robin, even though in 1987, Robin would constantly be getting gendered, you know, to match whatever sex they were assigned at birth. But I don't want to say that wasn't happening for our main character, but we just thought, what happens if we don't point the camera at that? What happens if the scene where Robin is being handed a gendered gym uniform is just not in our movie? What happens if we write all the lines in a way that we maybe never noticed that Robin doesn't ever get explicitly gendered? So that's the formal experiment of the movie. Can we get through the whole movie without disclosing or determining or nailing down a gender for Robin? But then the movie itself becomes this, Robin still has to get through grade 8. And the important questions, like, who do I like? Do they like me back? Who likes me? Do I like them back? And what am I willing to do to fit in? That becomes the real question. So that by the end, what are you isn't about what gender are you. It's about, like, what kind of person are you?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of interesting. I did a video essay last year, I think, about coming out narratives. And one of the things that is really tricky about them, I think, is that within the Western idea of storytelling, we have this three-act structure, and we ask a question in the first act and we complicate it in the second, we answer it in the third. And with coming out movies, you either have them that the coming out happens in the first, like it is the question at the beginning and they have to like get to the end where they've dealt with it, or it is the third act like answer. And so I think it's really interesting, and you're right, like kind of experimental in a way, to have a movie in which you don't allow the audience to have that finality, because I think that does mirror to me more accurately what it is like for a lot of young people to go through and try and be figuring out their identity, but not necessarily have nailed it down by the end of the three acts of Grade 8.
That's exactly right. I didn't want the movie to know more than the hero. And yeah, I remember that feeling of not having words, not having answers, still having to get through each day. So it's a tricky thing. I think in one way, that's why I was drawn to the really classic 1980s coming of age movie as something to... That's why when people would say, why does it have to be set in the 80s? That's more expensive. Could we set it now? No, because you want to start with it's a bait and switch. I love the way you talk about three acts. You know, in the first act, we raise this question, is Robin a boy or a girl? But by the end of the movie, it's like, oh, here's a more important question. What kind of person is Robin? And we don't even answer that one too explicitly. We just show Robin having the light bulb moment of, oh, that's a more important question. But we don't necessarily land on the side of, and I learned a lesson about bullying. So, you know, of course, what you get when you do something like that is people saying, oh, how unsatisfying. But then other people going, oh, how like being queer. And certainly that's my target audience.
Love that. And so Stand By Me, I totally, yeah, that makes sense to me in terms of both the connection to you and also, I guess, the connection to the film. But I'm pretty sure you're going to, for your next one, I see a connection to a very iconic queer movie within the cast, right?
I'm going to follow River Phoenix out of Stand By Me into My Own Private Idaho.
A good, real classic. But I say this, but I'm also very aware of the fact that I'm of, like, maybe people who listen to this podcast are young and sprightly, and that movie is not on any streaming platform, and they're like, what are you talking about? So could you, if you had to describe it for our listeners who maybe are not, haven't already voraciously watched that movie over and over again.
Oh, good. Okay. So this is an interesting exercise. Pitch that movie. Oh, let me think. So you meet River Phoenix. He's a narcoleptic street hustler in, I think, Seattle, and certainly the Pacific Northwest. And he's in love with his best friend, Scott Favor, played by Keanu Reeves. So you've got these guys playing street hustlers, sex workers. River Phoenix is narcoleptic and falls asleep at the most inopportune moments. And Keanu Reeves is his protector and his friend. And the River Phoenix character is very much in love with the Keanu Reeves character, who has these sort of lines within his identity. I think we come to understand him as bi, or we would say today probably pan. But he's got these rules around, like, he'll only do that for money, and he can't kiss. He doesn't kiss, you know? So there's this emotional inaccessibility. He doesn't want to go there with the River Phoenix character, but he loves him and he's devoted to him. So there's that kind of longing and inaccessibility and doomed romance built into it. And then the quest becomes that River Phoenix's character goes looking for his mother. He's certainly driven by flashbacks of a mother, and he's going looking for home. You know, I forget, it's been a little while since I've seen it, but I forget how explicit it is. I don't know if he's explicitly looking for his mother. I think maybe so, but certainly emotionally, that's what he's chasing. He's chasing home and mother. And so Keanu Reeves goes along with him on that quest, and then through that quest finds love with a woman in Europe, which of course breaks River Phoenix's character's heart. And there's this other sort of, the B story is that Keanu Reeves is the son of the mayor. And so he's always been expected to like give up his, it's based on Henry IV, part one, Shakespeare, where Prince Hal is running wild, but is always expected to come back and take up his responsibilities. And that's what happens to the Keanu Reeves character. He eventually, you know, turns his back on all his old friends and takes his place as a son of the city kind of thing.
I love a good Shakespeare retelling. Shakespeare, like the that those like teen movie Shakespeare retellings. We've not had one in a while, and I really feel like it's a shame. We need more of the...
Oh, we're due, aren't we?
We're kind of due it. Like, I feel like there were so many of them in the classics. I think I was talking about... What were you talking about? 10 Things I Hate About You with a previous guest as well. And like lots of... There's lots of these different adaptations that... I mean, Shakespeare is hella queer anyway, so it kind of just makes sense. There's a lot of... these men having extremely intense friendships on stage with him. I feel like Hamlet is the quintessential one. And then there's definitely something gay about Iago's truly just deep obsession with Othello that needs examining more closely, to my mind. But I think that this is one of those movies that kind of like A Price of Salt in terms of like Carol, where it's almost like the originator of some tropes or elements that we kind of have seen then over the years play out in other ways in movies. So having the queer teen hustler character, I'm thinking of like Mysterious Skin. I'm thinking of like Hunter and Queer as Folk.
Yes.
Like, which is kind of interesting. And also this very sort of in contrast to a lot of the more high concept, poppy, bright colored version of like straight coming of age teen movies of the time.
Yes.
There was something more like decidedly indie about it, which I think is a really interesting one, because you do wonder whether the thought was that teen movies with straight characters are for straight teens, whereas like coming of age movies with queer characters were for the adult queers who were like cinephiles who are watching it in a different kind of way. So they didn't necessarily need that classic, you know, pop soundtrack happy ending element to it, which we kind of feels like we're only just getting now within the sort of 20-teens and 2020s, because it's it's a very particular style of queer movie from that era, which is you're not exactly going to sit down and be like, what a fun time I'm having. This is, I mean, it's a good movie, but you're not exactly going like a joyride from start to finish. Exactly what I hoped my life would turn out like.
Yeah, I think that's very astute to think about who is the audience. And you know, you're always going to reach that now that kids, queer kids, out queer kids are watching these movies. Like, I'm having this experience with mine. Mine is definitely for the people like me who are nostalgic. It's the queer movie we couldn't have growing up in the 80s. Mm. But also, I'm very aware that, like, classrooms full of queer kids are watching this when on student film day at the film festival, you know? And that I was nervous about that. I was the most nerve-wracking screening I had was for busloads of high school kids at the Philadelphia Film Festival. I was so scared. And it was all these film students and autistic kids. I had this huge Cineplex auditorium full of the film students and the autistic kids from this high school in Philadelphia. And I was like, well, this is the trial by fire. And in the end, I was so happy because they wound up giving it a student award at that festival. And they really related to it and really got involved. It was the best Q&A the movie's had. So I thought, okay, great. So they don't always necessarily want the lollipop and rainbow and sunshine. Mm. It's not true to their experience.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Is this a movie that, in terms of your own queer experience and queer identity, was one of those ones that you were watching when it was first released? Or is it something you came to like later once you'd come into your queerness more and were like, oh, this is one of those classics I should watch?
No, I have the benefit of being old. Oh, I was getting these movies in real time. You know, I watched Stand By Me when it came out. I watched My Own Private Idaho when it came out.
And it was kind of resonant then.
Yeah. By then it's 1991. I'm 19 years old. I know who I am. And I know that now I'm liking River Phoenix. And I'm delighted to see him in a romance with Keanu Reeves. Are you kidding? Like, that was mind-blowing. They were the first, you know, marquee young actors to have the nerve to do a queer movie with a queer director, Gus Van Sant. And I mean, Gus Van Sant wasn't even expecting that. He had it in his mind that he was going to work with, I think he had a cast with these unknown actors, until all of a sudden he could have River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves in his movie, and everything changed. The budget changed. The whole plan for the movie changed. And fortunately, the movie stayed really queer.
Yeah, which is not necessarily a guarantee. And I do think that there is something like particularly landmark at that time in general to have the movie, but also with those particular actors. Like, it feels like even now it might be hard pressed to be like, oh, the darlings of the film industry who specifically are heartthrobs amongst, like, boys who are heartthrobs amongst girls, that they would even now still be wary to play these queer characters in how it might affect their careers, in how it might affect their roles going forward. So it feels like such a special movie for a bunch of reasons, but not least the kind of behind the scenes element of the film industry.
I can't express to you what a big deal it was to have those two actors in that movie. It was mind-blowing at the time. Now we see a Timothée Chalamet in a Call Me By Your Name, and we're like, oh, okay, yeah, I want to see that. That's sexy. But and now we even go, should maybe queer actors be playing some of these parts? A few of them? I'm in the process of putting the money together for my next movie, and we've got a queer male hero. It's set now in the 90s. I've moved from the 80s to the 90s. I'm tracking my development with my movies. And, you know, we're having the conversations about, can we put someone bankable in the role of the 18 to 26-year-old queer male protagonist? And I'm like, I'd love to. Who is that? Who is the bankable out queer young male actor? If you have ideas.
Still a tricky question.
Still a very tricky question.
To answer.
Yeah.
Amazing. Do you have a next step in our movie process? Have you got your next film you want to chat about?
Well, when I first started thinking about this line of liking The Bad Boys and how it, for better or for worse, has affected my life from my viewing, I went from Stand By Me to My Own Private Idaho. The next thing I thought about naturally was Law of Desire by Pedro Almodovar, which is, you know, a Spanish movie, again, from the 80s. I think it was 87? It's a very young Antonio Banderas who's not famous yet in North America. And again, he's the dangerous bad boy. And you've got the, you know, sort of more clean cut. We're adults now. We're dealing with adults. And you've got this adult filmmaker who's the hero of the story. Pablo Quintero is the character's name. And he's a successful gay out queer filmmaker in Spain in the 80s, and he's just had a very successful new opening of a new film, and he's in love with this younger man who's not really in love with him, but they're dating, and the younger man's going to go away for the summer and work and live with his family. But the Antonio Banderas character is obsessed with this famous, successful gay filmmaker and stalks him. And winds up, you know, it's a melodrama, so he winds up killing the other love interest and inserting himself into this filmmaker's life because he's obsessed. One thinks also with the filmmaker's status, you know, with his cultural success. He just wants to be in that life, and he sees, you know, that he can sleep his way into it. But beyond that, it becomes this very queer movie. You've got the main character, Pablo. He's got a sister, Tina, a trans sister, being played by Carmen Mara, who is a cisgender female actor. But it's, at least that's highly progressive for the 80s, that it's not being, the character's not being played by, you know, a cisgender male actor, which we get even now. We get these cisgender male actors playing trans women, which is so hurtful and so dangerous because it drills into the audience's mind this idea that it's a trick, it's an act, it's a costume, it's a role. But you've got Carmen Mora, a woman, playing Tina, the trans sister. So it's subconsciously reinforcing this idea, this fact, that trans women are women. So 1987, go to town, Pedro Almodovar. And almost as a balancing act, then you've got Bea Anderson, a trans actress. She's playing a cisgender character. So there's this beautiful, like, what would be progressive casting today in a way? I mean, not as progressive and wonderful and correct as having a trans actress play the trans character, but 1987, they were doing pretty good for their time. Yeah, but at the heart of it is this melodrama of obsession and desire and danger and the sexy bad boy being played by Antonio Banderas.
We have a theme running through the movies, and it's that Trevor needs a bad boy. Someone ship them in.
Oh, no, I think Trevor's had enough bad boys in his life. But Trevor can see the pattern now.
This is actually, like, really interesting to me because I'm currently just about to film a video about queer villains, because I think that this very particular idea of like the erotic thriller is such a staple of like the obsessive queer, is such a staple of the genre. And I feel like we've seen it very recently in Saltburn. It's like a talented Mr. Ripley angle of like the sometimes explicitly queer, sometimes coded queer character who becomes like utterly obsessed to the point of derangement. And that question of, I'm like fascinated by that question of how far queer villains are something which is inherently damaging, especially depending on the context of the time they're in, versus how much they're restricting them restricts like the artistic vision and the expansiveness of what queerness can be, and that it doesn't have to mean something. Like not every character who is a certain way is like an endorsement or a confirming of negative stereotypes, and that actually a lot of queer villains are some of the most beloved queer characters in that have been on screen, even by the queer community. Like thinking about Rocky Horror, thinking about like Ursula and like Disney villains and the glorious campness of them, you have that, I guess, balance of how far it is this, you know, perpetuating stereotypes and how far it is something which is just fun to watch. And especially when you're looking at something that's a melodrama. So is that like a thought that you're having around these sort of bad boy characters or these more villainous characters or these films which do deal with this kind of melodrama and thriller element of where those like stereotypes are coming from, things like that? Or is it just like, actually, when I'm watching them, that's not really coming into it, because ultimately it's about watching a film and enjoying it and getting from it what you want, rather than thinking that it sort of symbolizes something larger about the queer community?
You know, back to the 90s, I was conscious of the new queer cinema as it was happening. And part of that was coming out of a time when the queer characters were these noble, dying, you know, we were fine as long as we were noble, and we were dead of AIDS by the end of the movie. So there was this very kind of unsexed, diseased, noble, doomed, honorable, queer, gay character in the 80s. And then the new queer cinema took back so much power by celebrating antiheroes. I mean, look at anything Christine Vachon produced. Look at Poison by Todd Haynes, which there's characters really like Leopold and Loeb, the child-murdering homosexuals that Rope is coded about, but not, you know, Hitchcock's Rope is about them, but it's not them, and they're not explicitly gay. But by 1995, it's Leopold, it's Loeb, they're gay, and they're the anti-heroes of the story. And it's a way of reclaiming narrative power to say, we can be anti-heroes as well. We don't have to be your noble, dying swan, you know. We can also be the dangerous, erotic, murderous, obsessive, you know, which taps into a lot of the darkness of, like, it puts power back into desire, you know? And so it's always a dance with the representation. And you can have the perfectly good character, you can have the dangerous child-murdering character, and then, you know, you can have characters who are ultimately a bit of both, just like everybody really is, you know? Nobody's totally good, nobody's totally evil. So the drama I like knows that and looks for contradictions in characters.
I love that. So when you were watching this movie for the first time, what was your connection to it? Like, what was your take in it? Was it just something where you were like, this is paralleling my own relationships with the bad boys, this is my wake-up call? Or was it this is something that, as someone who's an aspiring filmmaker, you were looking at from an artistic point of view? Like, where was that connection for you?
I think the thing that sticks with me the most, that still hasn't left, was a sense of the movie didn't exist to justify the characters. The movie wasn't one whole argument that we deserve love, we deserve respect, we deserve to exist. It just took that all as a given. That's just the ground from which we begin. And now we're going to tell a story about these people. And, you know, oh, somebody's a sex worker. No judgment. Oh, somebody's doing drugs. No judgment. And I was used to all these movies where you see somebody do drugs and they're going to get punished. They're probably going to die. They're going to go to jail. Something. There was always checks and balances and a kind of moral math to these movies. And suddenly you had a movie where these are artists. Somebody's off in the bathroom doing drugs and it's not a big deal. And somebody has worked as a sex worker and it's not a big deal. And it was all just taken as foundational, accepted. This is who the story's about. And they're great people and they're fabulous characters. And let's see what this story tells us. And it wasn't the point of the movie. So I remember having that feeling, being shocked by that feeling when I first saw it, because it was really one of the first movies I ever saw that did that. And it's what I'm pursuing to this day. Like, even you heard me talk about my own movie. Robin walks in, everybody wants to know if they're a boy or a girl, and the movie isn't interested in that question.
Yeah, it's almost like taking, especially when you've got characters who are queer, who are then within a sort of cis-normative, heteronormative world, that it's that balance, I guess, of them butting up against that world, that like how much you allow that world to be part of the narrative you're telling, how far that is part of the tensions of the movie, how far that is something that is present versus what does it look like, I guess. Is it possible to have a movie in which it doesn't have to engage with that at all, like it doesn't tackle that at all? Is that those people who are asking the question at the beginning and the world in which Robin is inhabiting, was that something that you were aware of wanting to be discussing, wanting to reflect in terms of like queer young person's experience when they are within these environments themselves? And was that something that you were deliberately getting tension from? Or was it kind of like a not as concerned with it, but it just, it's going to be there and it will have an effect because that's kind of just reality?
Yeah, for me, it was an attempt to get into the real subjectivity of the kid, to place the kid at the center of the story. To me, it comes back to this idea of like, the trope of marginalization, right? Mm-hmm. Is it functioning in the story? And so those movies that are very much like aimed at a straight audience and are pleas for acceptance, they rely on this trope of marginalization. We're on the outside, please let us in. And that's important. You got to fight for your rights, got to fight for your right to party. But then there's, you know, a queer art I love that centers the subjective experience. We're not necessarily, by definition, at the margins. We are in the center of the story. Or you can take, as you're talking about with Shakespeare, you can queer the canon. And what if we just take it as a given? What if we just put our subjectivity right smack in the middle and don't justify it? And mm-hmm. So for me, it was, to start the movie in a sex ed class that's taking place in a physical education gym class. Everybody's in their gendered gym uniforms, boys on this side, girls on that side. Teacher's putting a condom on a banana for the first ever safe sex demonstration at this school in the 80s. And that's the moment our character walks into this highly sexualized, highly gendered environment and is told, go find a place to sit. And has to mm-hmm. decide, are you going to sit on the boy's side? Are you going to sit on the girl's side? And Robin goes and sits at the back in the middle, doesn't choose a side. And then the whole movie is in Robin's subjectivity. So if Robin didn't have words for gender, I didn't want the movie to apply words for gender to Robin.
Yeah.
And it's that sense of like, what happens if we put our subjectivity so solidly at the middle that even an environment like a junior high school in the 80s that demands answers, let's just not let the movie go there. So that certainly going for a tension between that, but in a way, flipping the margin. Suddenly everybody else is outside the margin and Robin's in the middle. And how much is allowed into Robin's experience as we represent it in the movie?
Love that. So what else is on your list? You've got some, we've had kind of our journey has taken us through these different kind of connections between them. Have you got another one that's going to take a leap somewhere different, or are we following that same path?
You know, the other one that sprang to my mind that was important to me as I was, you know, becoming queer was the movie Torch Song Trilogy, Harvey Fierstein. It's a 1988 film. It's adapted from a Broadway play called Torch Song Trilogy, which was itself originally three short plays, which is why it's called Torch Song Trilogy. The three plays were put together into one Broadway show. That Broadway show was adapted into this movie. And so it's Harvey Fierstein, a young Harvey Fierstein, imagine, as Arnold, this New York drag queen, who in the first story of the trilogy is in love with, you know, bisexual Ed from the suburbs. I think maybe Long Island. It's been a while since I've seen it. But Ed is definitely coming into town to see Arnold, but kind of has this more closeted, heteronormative life outside Manhattan. And so in a way, there's that sort of doomed, I'll never fully have him. And then by chapter two, that's a young Matthew Broderick playing a sex worker who falls in love with Arnold. And they actually start a healthy relationship and they're making plans to adopt a kid. So the movie's moving from Arnold's in the dressing room at the drag club getting into drag to now Arnold is like making plans to adopt and to have a more traditional relationship with Alan, played by Matthew Broderick. And in the story, then Matthew Broderick's character is gay-bashed as they're moving into their new home where they're planning to adopt the kid. And he dies. And so Arnold, once again, brokenhearted. Torch Song Trilogy. You're beginning to see the pattern. Poor Arnold's heart keeps breaking. And then by the third act, it's more about the mother, played by Anne Bancroft. And you really get the relationship between Arnold and his mother. Because Arnold has adopted, as a single parent, Arnold has adopted a teenager who himself is a queer youth. And Arnold is giving this kid a home and helping raise this kid. And the mother is trying to understand what's going on. And then the mother, you know, there's the mother's a widow. Arnold is a widower. And it's Arnold trying to have his mother see, I've lost too, you know. This is, we have grief. We should be sharing our grief. So it's an interesting, I think, development of Arnold never really does get the love interest that he wants, but winds up at the end of the movie, it's blocked in such a way that Arnold has like still a friendship with bisexual Ed, who married a woman. So he's got a friendship with Ed. He's got the memory of Alan, and he's got the real relationships with his mother, who he has drawn a boundary with and said, if you can't respect me, you're not in my life, and has this healthy relationship with this kid that he's providing a home for. So it's a maturation in a way of the story, of the trope. It's still got all that longing, you know, and that when the wind whips through your heart, it's got that emo thing that the others have, but it's a more domestic emo thing that's happening. So it's
I was like, that's the genre, domestic emo.
It's very domestic emo. I think we've stumbled on something together.
I think that also that's like, it's also so aggressively Broadway play. Like it's such a, like, just so, like, just even the name Arnold, something about the name Arnold from a queer person in a Broadway play, I'm like, yep, that checks. That makes complete sense to me. Yeah, I also like this idea of the, like, what queer narratives where you aren't necessarily doing a coming of age teen movie and not either doing a straight romance in some way, but there are like other areas of life for a queer person which can make their way onto the screen. And I think that's really interesting as like somewhere to go, especially again with a movie that's not super recent, that's older and that is essentially like within a time in which that was not just, that wasn't typical, but that wasn't legal in a lot of places. The idea of having a, being able to get married, being able to adopt, like that was just not a possibility. It's kind of such an interesting one. Was that something in terms of where you were in your life when it was, when you were watching that, was that something that you had, were reckoning with in terms of being a queer person, looking at what your future looked like, looking at what domestic emo looked like for you? Was that something you were kind of aware of?
Precisely. Absolutely. You've put your finger right on it. And again, you've put your finger right on what it felt like to see this, because all the movies, like all the movies, we were either dying of AIDS or we were coming out or we were falling into bed. Those were all the stories. And so to see one reckoning with, you know, what we would say now, doing laundry and paying taxes, was hopeful, very hopeful.
It's such a, I mean, it's such an interesting one of, with queer movies, I sometimes do find that we are in this struggle sometimes between, it's getting a bit different now, I think, but this struggle between the mainstream that allows you to access money, allows you to access equipment and resources, allows you to access audiences in a lot of cases, especially kind of in the pre-stream era. And, but then also it's like, how much are you, I guess it's how much are you having to curtail or not necessarily censor, but are limited by, on one hand, a lack of funding, a lack of support, a lack of being able to reach an audience, in terms of more indie productions versus being hindered by the gatekeeping or the rules or the edits that are made within a more mainstream kind of cinema. And I think we are seeing a little bit of a mix up, but not entirely. And I think, so for example, like Bottoms, which is a movie that has done extremely well and was doing some really interesting stuff with unlikable queer characters, with like teen movies, all of this stuff, was originally meant to have an extremely limited run that I can only assume was only really there in order to allow them to be nominatable for particular awards. But that was, it kind of took the fact that the two leads were in some extremely popular breakout shows and movies in between that film being made and us getting to see it to even justify getting more than an extremely limited run. So even the movies that seem like, oh, these are really, you know, slam dunks, are not necessarily getting that same mainstream respect. And I do wonder if that's like a something that you think about as a filmmaker in terms of what types of movies you want to make, like how independent versus mainstream you're looking to go. Is that something that you have in your head a specific path for where you want to be going? Or is it something where you're like, I'm at the moment just whatever opportunities come up, I'm going to figure out a way of making queer cinema from that?
Oh, you know, you put your finger right on a sore spot. So, I mean, I came from making short films in Canada, which are, we're lucky in Canada, you can access government grants from arts councils to make short films. So I did that. And you're being judged, the people who are deciding whether or not you get the money, it's juries of your peers. It's working artists who are coming together to be on these juries and decide who gets the money. So you wind up getting rewarded for being bold. You wind up getting rewarded for making the proposal that impresses the other artists on the jury who are deciding who gets the money. And that was my path, to the point that, like, by my 11th short film, it was just two erect penises in outer space.
Classic. A classic of the genre.
Funded by three levels of government. And, you know, one eats the other and it's called docking.
Iconic. Truly iconic.
I had to reapply for many years before I found the right jury that wanted to fund that, you know. But in the end, I did. And then, of course, what happens is, you're right. You know, guess who wants it? Sundance. And it opens the midnight section at Sundance after fighting and telling people this will work. So I think it's that. I think we as queer artists know, hey, there's an audience for this. This is going to work. But it's often scary and bold and, oh, dare we? And then, but if you get it made, the audience is there going, why doesn't this happen more often? So it takes the right people to see that that the queer audience is hungry for interesting art. I should do a plug and say that people can watch that short film on my website, trevorandersonfilms.com. So if you want to see my...
Go and see it. Go and watch it immediately, everyone.
Penis-y space opera. It's 4 minutes long. But there's a feature film script of this idea. I just thought, what's my least adaptable idea? It's the two penises in outer space. How would we make a feature? I wanted to be able to stand there in the Q&As and tell the audience there was a feature film adaptation of this short film. And so I made one up. And so my writing partner, Frish Krakowski, and I have written the feature version of Docking, which the quick pitch of that is, you know, Ricky starts dating again to get over his closeted ex-boyfriend. Now, after our conversation, you can see the pattern there. Ricky starts dating again to get over his closeted ex-boyfriend. At the exact moment, a space alien in human form begins to stalk the city, consuming men with its monstrous penis.
A classic. Yes, of course.
Meanwhile, his two best friends, a lesbian couple, both of them heavily pregnant because they're that competitive, become amateur sleuths determined to solve the mystery. So the lesbians are going to, like, Scooby-Doo the mystery of these disappearing men.
They're Velmering it up.
Exactly. And I went to the feature funders first with that idea. I went to our national funders and went, okay, get this, a guy who eats people with his dick. And of course they were like, no, because the feature funding in our country is not the same. It's it's bureaucrats who don't want to lose their jobs who decide who gets the money. And so they literally said, do you have anything safer? Which led me to this gentle coming of age where nobody could tell if Robin was a boy or a girl. I still love it. I'm still super proud of it. I think we smuggled in a bunch of subversive elements. But, you know, how did Bottoms get its budget of $10 million US dollars? You know, that's not really that's a dying breed, the $10 million indie. I think it's because the director, Emma Seligman, had made this wonderful movie, Shiva Baby, and proven herself. And Rachel Sennett and Iowa Debary were, as you say, in more successful things. They had a bit of bank. And so somebody, some visionary somebody, said, give them $10 million and let's see what happens. But even then, as you say, they weren't really supporting the rollout until the queer audience went, support the rollout. And then suddenly it was the giant hit that it was. So it's still threading a needle to get the money, to get the movie made. And hopefully by, you know, proving myself with the safer coming of age movie, now I can go, so about the guy who eats people with his dick?
About that one, actually.
I know that if we do that right, with the right queer comic actors in it, it'll be a big, fun genre queer midnight comedy, which people are hungry for.
Yeah, I mean, like, truly, if you put down top 10 queer sci-fi movies, there's simply not 10 to put on that list. You'd be kind of hard-pressed to get them in there. And me and Jazza in our main episodes do it kind of by genre. So we go through, we pick a genre, we pick a movie, and then we talk about the genre, the context of the movie, like how it fits in. And queer sci-fi is one of those ones that is really tricky because you can kind of start to do the working it back and talking about, like, okay, well, does The Matrix count? Like, we can definitely do readings of that. And then we were looking at, like, how far, like, where does sci-fi extend into? And then we ended up going with an extremely unhinged indie pick, which was the codependent lesbian space alien Seek Same.
I was at the Sundance premiere of that. I was there.
Jazza loved that movie so much more that we went in, I think, thinking we'd have the opposite opinions, and then it came through. It's exactly Jazza's brand of nonsense, but in the best way. And I guess it goes back to that idea of what we currently have in terms of queer movies where the queerness is central, which is absolutely a kind of queer movie that we want. But I think there's also the queer movies where we're looking at other genres, where there's other things happening, where you have the Stand By Me type of coming of age, where there is a coming of age, but there's also the dead body that they're investigating. Like, you want the Stranger Things of, like, there's a bunch of kids who are discovering who they are, but they're also fighting monsters. And that, I think, that extra element of genre, of, like, something a bit more risky, something that feels like it's really specific, is not necessarily getting its due in a lot of ways.
We want movies to be fun.
Yes.
We as viewers want movies to be fun. And, you know, when they get a little too important, we forget that it can be both important and fun, and that it's important to have fun.
This is so true. I mean, and here's a plug for future episodes of this podcast. We're doing a Nimona episode, which is very good fun cartoon. And we also are going to be doing Driveaway Dolls, because I just got a code for a screener for it, which is really exciting, that I sent over to Jazza. Normally Jazza's the one who gets to watch everything first, because they are currently living in New York, as they keep telling everyone and on the podcast, even though it has been over a year. So very excited to be able to do some really fun queer movies, fun sort of lesbian and trans non-binary, like, queer movies as well, which is really exciting. We have reached the end of our time recording. I feel like we could have talked for hours more.
I've been a delight. I love talking with you. You remind me, you make me want to end on a joke, which is, how do you know if somebody lives in New York?
How?
They tell you they live in New York.
They absolutely tell you they live in New York.
Jazza, this is a big call out for you when you listen to this episode. You are the one we're referencing here. Amazing. So if people want to find you, the movie, let them know how they can do that.
Before I change my mind, I think the best way to find out about it is my website, trevorandersonfilms.com. You can watch all my shorts for free, and there's a page for Before I Change My Mind, which I'm always going to keep updated. In North America, it's already available on VOD in the USA, anywhere you rent or buy movies. And it's coming out in Canada theatrically in April, and by May, it'll be available to rent or buy in Canada, anywhere you get your movies. And we're hoping for more international distribution opportunities. But like I say, either if you're on Instagram, there's a page for Before I Change My Mind. It's called Before I Change My Mind. I'm Trevor_A, like the Canadian, A-E-H. So T-R-E-V-O-R _E-H. But the website has all this, trevorandersonfilms.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much for chatting with us. That is another episode of the Queer Movie Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then make sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast so you are primed for our next one in your podcast app of choice. And if you like what you hear, particularly a lot, then please consider supporting us over on Patreon, where we have some very fun perks to offer, including a monthly queer movie watch along on our Discord. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where we will post things as and when we remember, which isn't always. Until we see you next time, goodbye. We'll be right back.